It is Thursday night, and we are heading into the weekend as the jury deliberates. The prosecution and the defense both gave their closing arguments, and we have in studio with us, of course, Andre and I have been following this, and we've had the opportunity to check in with Eric Rung, who has been at the courtroom for many of the courtroom days, and including being every single one, and you've been in the courtroom for some of them. Oh, you're on five. 1 second. There you go.
Well, I've been in the overflow room for some of the testimony just because I'd have to pop out in and out just to give reports. But for the most part, and I was in the courtroom when Jason Van Dyke gave his testimony, which was, what everybody was waiting for in this case is to hear exactly how he would explain why he shot 16 times that night.
Yeah, that's an incredible day in courtroom history in Chicago, and I want to get your thoughts on that, too. And we also want to check in with Domati Pongo, who is at the at South Shore, where they had a press conference and a march there. Hey, Domati, how are you doing?
I'm good, man. How are you guys?
Very well, thank you. So tell me, what was going on at South Shore?
So at 71st and Chappelle, some activists gathered. William Calloway was leading it. He was one of the activists that first, you know, helped in releasing a lot of the information around the Laquan McDonald shooting in the first place. But he and about, I would say, a little over two dozen other activists were there talking about what they plan to see. They were calling for a guilty verdict, and they were letting community members know, listen, let's make our voices heard, but let's not riot, let's not destroy our communities, and let's make sure we do this in a peaceful way.
I'm glad you brought that up too, Domati, because I know William Calloway has been very vocal about this. Good evening to you, by the way, and thanks for staying up and joining us, because I know you've been on this rally and protest all night too. But William Calloway has been very vocal, Willie Wilson, and I think even Laquan McDonald's mom one day outside of court said, please be peaceful. So is that kind of the message that you're sensing tonight, that whatever verdict is handed down, that there will be some sort of demonstrations, but the leaders of these demonstrations are urging for, no riots and just to be somewhat calm, but yet still expressing your either satisfaction or displeasure?
Yes, but what was interesting today, which was different than when I've heard William Calloway give the same message at the courthouse, was being on 71st and Chappelle, you had people walking past and just, like, organically joining the press conference. And there was one woman who walked past, and as William Calloway was speaking, she shouts out, ask them why did the police kill my son. Ask them why the police killed my son out of nowhere. And then just continues walking. And so Calloway said, listen, we're going to speak aggressively, passionately, and we're going to, shut the city down. We're going to march downtown in front of City Hall, but we're going to do it all peacefully. So there was an aggression, and there was still this idea.
Oh, no.
Mean kind marching, or does it mean that you might not say things that people might not agree with? So there was a fervor, like a passion, and anger, but still this call for folks to be peaceful.
Domati, just out of curiosity, when this videotape, the dash camera video that we know all so well, you could almost feel kind of the intensity when these demonstrations were happening. Did you feel that same kind of intensity tonight?
I really did. I did. It was interesting because even outside the courthouse, every day there have been protesters out there. But, how many has varied. One day there may be four guys, and the next day there may be a dozen, et cetera. But today, even before the cameras came out from the news crews, there was a guy who had his Facebook Live phone up and had his camera on the police officers and was just shouting them down. He didn't touch them. He didn't get within 5 feet of them, but he was shouting them down aggressively. Other activists were just telling him, hey, just calm down. The police, the cameras are here. If they record you and they show you cursing, it's going to seem like, we're not presenting ourselves professionally. And so there was this energy, this tension between them and the half dozen or so police officers that were just there just to make sure that, everything was under control. But, yeah, it reminded me of the same energy that I saw a few years ago when the video first leaked and when I saw these activists marching up Michigan Avenue, shutting it down on Black Friday in 2015, I think that was.
Since we are so far into the, obviously now that it's gone to the jury a lot of people have had the opportunity to listen to testimony, to watch on CLTV, did you speak to anybody who had been following the courtroom as the story unfolded that way?
Yes, mainly Will and another activist who had been watching on CLTV back at home. And they started poke holes in these different things in the case. They weren't shy about saying that they felt that Jason Van Dyke's testimony contradicted what we saw in the video. Now, of course, the defense is saying that what the video shows is this perspective of a dash cam, a car that wasn't Jason Van Dyke's car. So we don't see in the video that looks like he's walking away. The defense would say he was actually walking toward Jason Van Dyke, closing in at about 13 feet or so. I know Eric will have more on that piece. But a lot of folks were talking about that. They're saying, you mean to tell me the defense, you know, someone I was talking to said, you mean to tell me the defense wants me to believe Jason Van Dyke's testimony over what I saw with my own eyes? And they were also saying that, you know, those tears won't work. You know, they felt that the tears were inappropriate, were insincere. And they also talked about the idea that he said that what he did was part of his police training. They said that it's hard for me to believe, and we have a serious problem if the police trains you to shoot someone 16 times within 6 seconds of arriving on the scene. And if the training does tell you that, then we have to make some changes as far as that goes as well.
Hey, Domati, also, as I'm sure you know, there were two of the alternate jurors that were dismissed tonight and spoke to reporters. Both of them said that if they were in that jury room, they would have voted guilty. One of the gentlemen said that he would have been voted guilty on first degree murder. The second said she was leaning toward second degree murder. As word of that got out, how did the protesters react to that? Obviously, I'm assuming that they think that it was that gives them some confidence going forward here. But were they surprised? How did they react to that?
Actually, at the time when I'd gotten there, I don't think, because they've been planning to protest all that time and folks were checking their phones, I don't know if they've seen that report yet from the alternate jurors, because they're running around all day working on the things of the case and working out that whole thing. But I did hear William Calloway say that he was okay with a first degree or a second degree murder conviction, which was something I hadn't heard them say before. They were saying that, I remember early on, you might remember this too, Eric, when Anita Alvarez first charged him with first degree murder, a lot of folks were scared that she'd overcharged him and, you know, didn't know that if a police officer in a shooting is found that he killed someone unjustified, that could be a first-degree murder charge. They were worried that the prosecution would have to find him, you know, would say that he premeditated that. Like, he woke up that morning and said he wanted to shoot Laquan McDonald. And so they said, listen, if he's found guilty of first or second degree murder, we're okay with that. And they're also skeptical about, you know, those alternate jurors don't represent the full jury makeup, which only includes one African American. Like, Cook County is 25% black, Chicago 30% black. How is it 1/12 of the jury is African American? How are we going to get a fair shake in a case this racially charged? That's what folks are saying out there.
Hey, Domati, what are they saying as far as, I know there's more demonstrations planned for tomorrow, and I think they're going to continue something at the courthouse as well. Are you getting any indication of if these are going to be coordinated kind of across the city in different areas? I also heard there was a gathering in Humboldt Park, too. So, but are there going to be kind of coordinated gatherings until the verdict is read, and then one big demonstration like in a centralized location? Or what are you hearing as far as staging for the next couple of days?
Yeah, that's what they're trying to do, especially William Calloway. He's trying to coordinate all of these efforts, and different activist groups are trying to coalesce under this umbrella. There's one group, the Alliance Against Racial and Political Oppression, I believe it's called. I may have some of the acronym mixed up, but it's a cadre of organizations, a group that serves kind of like an umbrella organization over all of these organizations so that their actions can be, you know, coordinated. The problem with that is, as you know, we saw with the Father Flager protest later on, followed by the Reverend Gregory Livingston protest and the activist community in Chicago, everyone has different thoughts, different agenda, and different ways and methods of moving around. So you know that their effort is to put together marches at City Hall. They want to march, bring the march downtown. They want to march in the Loop. They want to go areas away from the neighborhood so that we don't have a situation where they're burning down their own communities, but that they're peacefully marching in areas where legislators pay attention. But you also have other activist groups who the media may not know so well who are going to have their one-off protests as well.
Do you have any sense, because people are wondering about the marathon this weekend. We actually have a texter who's asking about that. I'll be running the marathon this weekend. And is the city saying anything about safety for the runners and spectators? Do you have any? Have you heard any word about disrupting the marathon?
I haven't heard any word yet, but it wouldn't surprise me if it happened. I actually was talking to some folks about that, and they were pretty elusive with giving me that information. So hopefully I find out more about what they plan to do this weekend so we can have the heads up at least. But I know the Chicago Police Department is certainly beefing up security to make sure that isn't disrupted.
Keep us posted, yeah. Domati, because I'm covering the marathon for TV and Eric is supposed to be covering the protest on Sunday. So we're going to kind of tag team it.
I mean, yeah, yeah, you're talking a million people in downtown Chicago on Sunday.
Yeah.
Domati, if you don't mind, maybe we can check in with you tomorrow night after the game if you're still up for it. I know that you've got a long weekend ahead of you, but if you don't mind, we'd like to check in again.
I'd love to. I don't plan on sleeping this weekend. So
thanks, Domati.
Right. I haven't slept in 2.5 weeks, Domati, so we're in good company.
Thanks, Domati.
You guys can share the couch in the newsroom. All right, Domati. Yeah, it is a big couch. Big. They can cuddle. I made it weird. All right. Thanks, Domati. Have a good night. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
I'll cuddle with you guys tomorrow night.
All right.
We all need some cuddling now.
I know. Would you cuddle with me?
It's been an intense couple of weeks, that's for sure.
Yeah. I'm gonna go cuddle in my office by myself in a minute. Just because HR said to. More after this on WGN 720. There's something I've been wanting to talk about for the last couple days. And what was it like to be in the courtroom when Jason Van Dyke took the stand? It's the Patty Vasquez Show with Andrea Darlis. And Eric Rung was there. He was a couple rows back behind the prosecution's table.
Yep.
And people saw you. We saw you on TV. And I was like, I got to talk to him. And so now you've had some time to process it. All the energy. I'm sure that this is also crystal clear in your mind. First of all, when you heard that they were that he was going to take the stand, what did the courtroom even seem like? I mean, because Andrew thought he should.
There's a lot of people that thought he should. I remember talking to Joe Roddy, and he was telling me, he was a former prosecutor. He told me, he said, the defense that they're putting on, he has to take the stand because his whole case rests on what he perceived as being a threat. So, and there had been whispers about it throughout the courthouse for the week prior, actually, that he was going to take the stand. It was always just kind of win. But you could really see the strategy that the defense put on there, because the first person they put on before Van Dyke was the psychologist. And he talked about how that when people are involved in dangerous situations, that their brains kind of put memory building on hold. They kind of suppress that because your brain is trying to figure out, how do I get out of this danger? How do I protect myself? How do I protect these other people? So that's why you may not remember exactly as things happened that night. You may have a different perception. Right. Time was slow. You had tunnel vision, didn't hear everything. And then right after that is when they put Van Dyke on. And everybody was a little surprised that they put him on so early. We figured if they were going to put him on, he was going to be the last witness for the defense.
Really? Okay.
But that wasn't the case. And you could see now it's clear with 2020 hindsight why they did it the way they did it, is because the psychologist got up and talked about how, you know, people involved in these situations don't remember things exactly the way they may seem. And of course, we all have the videotape that shows what happened that night. Maybe not directly from his perspective, but it gives us a really good idea. And so the prosecution or the defense had him go through it, had him go through the video, tell him what they saw or what he saw with Laquan McDonald. He talked about this teenager that was whacked out, had bugged eyes, and was staring at him and turned his torso toward him and the knife up and pointed it at him. And that's when he fired the shots. He said he could see into the soul of Laquan McDonald.
Oh, I've missed that part where he said he could see into the soul of Laquan McDonald.
Yeah.
I want to ask, too, about that and then the PCP, you know, Laquan McDonald, you know, the drugs that were in his system. But I'm curious, when we were watching it, I mean, because we were texting Penny, you and I, during the trial, and I mean, glued to it, and you're in the courtroom, and Jason Van Dyke, and I think this might have been methodical, how he made these big, long pauses before he answered.
Oh, he got emotional, too. Yeah,
yeah. And he got emotional and stuff. I guess I'm curious how that was perceived by the jury. Did they lean in, or did they show any emotion at all?
This jury has not shown emotion at all throughout the entire trial. They really didn't show anything. I mean, you could tell when there were some exchanges between either the prosecution or the defense attorneys and a witness, they would kind of peek their heads up. But for the most part, they kept a straight face. They kept their heads in their notebook. They took a lot of notes. Some took pages after pages of notes while others were...
That'd be me. I take notes on everything.
Well, I'm the same way.
Oh, my God.
Well, usually in cases like this, and I've noticed this about juries, is usually the first couple of days, they're almost writing down every single word. And as the trial continues, they write less and less. But I would say it was pretty consistent throughout this trial. The ones that were taking notes were taking notes. What was also interesting, though, especially when Van Dyke took the stand, and I had to remember to get myself out of tunnel vision while I was in there because I was so focused on what he was saying and wanted to make sure that I got everything right and taking good notes, that I would look around and I would look at the jury to see how they were taking in some of this stuff. And then I would turn around and I would look at Van Dyke's wife, who was sitting just a row behind me, and she was holding the hand of another family member. They had the nun from their parish there. She was saying the rosary out loud during his testimony. And then you also saw Laquan McDonald's uncle, great uncle, that was in there. And during one of the breaks when Van Dyke was on the stand, Laquan McDonald's mother did get up and leave, and she didn't return.
Okay.
And the great uncle who's been talking to the media throughout this entire case so far said, you know, it was just too much for her.
I would imagine.
And Van Dyke got emotional too when he was talking about going through that night and reliving it. He got choked up. He wiped away tears.
Was it hard to hear in the courtroom because he kept asking the prosecutor, and again, maybe this was methodical on...
To slow everything down.
To slow the proceedings down so he could get his thought. I mean, it is intimidating to testify for anybody.
Right.
Was it hard to hear because he kept saying, I'm sorry, can you repeat that, miss?
Well, I think he was buying time.
Okay.
I mean, it looked like a stall tactic to me. You know, maybe he just didn't hear, or maybe he just wanted to make sure that he got it exactly right.
Right.
Now, one thing that I have heard throughout the courtroom, too, or courthouse, I should say, from several different people, attorneys and whatnot, is that they thought the prosecution didn't go hard enough on him. Mm. That they almost had Van Dyke on the ropes a couple of times.
And then she just stopped all of a sudden.
Yeah, and then took a step back.
Right.
And so people were a little curious about that. But I think they did today on their closing arguments. They went strong and they went hard.
Well, especially when she got him to say that he was shooting at the knife and no longer what his training sort of supports, which is center mass.
Right.
He said he was trying to shoot the knife out of his hand.
Right.
And which is an interesting thing for him to say. That was the first time I'd ever heard anything like that.
It's the first time I think anybody had heard that. And the other thing that she asked him is, you say that he turned to you and he raised his arm and he pointed at you. Yes, that's what I saw. Why don't we see any of that on the videotape? Why don't we see any of that even on the animation that your defense attorneys paid for to have made to show your perspective? And then he said, and I thought this was interesting too, he said, well, that really wasn't my perspective either.
Right, because it's behind his head, he said.
It was behind his head.
Yeah, exactly.
But then at the same time, though, that animation, one thing it did do is it showed the distance between the two, and it showed that Laquan McDonald, while it may appear and does look like he is veering away from him, that he was still closing the distance between the two. But it didn't account, I don't think, for Van Dyke taking two steps toward Laquan McDonald either when he got out of the squad car.
So Jason Van Dyke's defense, of course, and you alluded to it earlier, Eric, is when he said he locked eyes with Laquan McDonald and saw through his soul. He locked eyes. That's the moment where he feared for his life and started firing the weapon, which was interesting to me because the juror who was dismissed today, the female who said she would have voted guilty, said that she didn't buy the argument that Laquan McDonald was on PCP and was high at the time. This is her view and her opinion. She was an alternate. She was dismissed, so she's not voting. But she said that she didn't think anything Laquan McDonald's mental state or anything he had done before, including being high on PCP, should have had anything to do with him being shot. So my question to you, Eric, is today during the defense, their closings, did they hammer that home? Like, did they really push that?
They pushed PCP.
High.
Yeah, they did.
Oh,
PCP.
they've pushed.
So I'm just curious why. I mean, if that's the whole defense, that the juror, this particular juror, didn't want to have anything to do with that theory, which is kind of the whole basis for the defense.
Well, the defense, since day one, they've put Laquan McDonald on trial and shown how he was this dangerous teenager out to, you know, cause all kinds of problems around the city.
Right, which would, I guess, speak to his mental state, too, because if you're arriving at a scene knowing that this person had been either slashing tires or 911 had been called on him and that his mental state, you know, that he was high, You know, I'm just curious as to why they wouldn't take that into account.
Well, I don't think it ever came over the radio transmissions that he was high. I think the only thing that came over the radio transmissions was that he had punctured the tire and tried to hit the windshield with the knife.
Got it.
And see, and this was also the interesting thing that came out from the prosecution, and they hammered this home in the closing arguments today, too, is they used some of Van Dyke's own words against him, knowing that he didn't know that he had almost tried to stab the truck driver when he was caught stealing radios and what have you, that once he heard that radio transmission that Laquan McDonald had punctured the tire, he had said to his partner, "Why aren't they shooting him?" And as more radio transmissions came in, he even said, "Oh my gosh, we're going to have to shoot him." And that was prior to he hadn't seen him yet.
He hadn't seen him yet.
And so the prosecution said Laquan McDonald never had a chance because he had already thought about what he was going to do when he confronted the teenager. Now, the defense would argue that that's
right,
not the case at
exactly,
all,
and
you know, he got out of the car and saw the threat.
Right.
Look, and I know this, a lot of this has to do with training and adrenaline from the 815. How many seconds did his gun take to fire those shots? I feel for this guy. Adrenaline works to allow us to survive. And I think that there are a lot of different ways to look at this story, and now it rests with the jury. It's, you know, we can judge all we want based on the videos.
And we can guess all we want,
yes,
too.
But,
I mean, we just don't know.
It's now in the hands of the jury. I want to thank you so much for all your coverage.
Absolutely.
Eric. Get some rest. We'll try to check in with you again.
Absolutely.
And yeah, please get some rest.
Yeah. Busy weekend.
Do I look that bad?
No. I just know how hard you've been working.
Good thing we're on the radio.
You look great. I'm astounded by how great you look. I just mean I know that you've been working really hard, and I want you to take care of yourself.
You.
I want you to get ahead of not looking good. How's that?
Yeah. All right. I like
That's
it.
Great.
I like
Eric.
It. Have a
good
anytime, great job. Guys.
Great
anytime.
Job. Thank you so much for joining us. More in a moment on 720 WGN. Throughout the Jason Van Dyke trial, WGN Radio and CLTV have been live streaming it. Andrea Darlis and I have been following it as well. I know Michael Heidemann has been checking in with the story, but there are a few people as close to this as far as in our family as Doma T. Pongo, who we checked in with. We had Eric Rung, who was in the courtroom, and also joining us on the line is Rich Lenkov, who co-hosts Legal Face-Off with Tina Martini, which you can find every week on WGNplus.com. And he's also, I heard this earlier on Rokan's show, so I'm not sure if I'm supposed to legally say he's with Bryce Downey and Lenkov LLC, but I'll go ahead and use that as well, Rich.
If you don't mention the LLC, I'm going after Heidemann, like, right away, so it's probably a good idea that you are.
There you go. Perfect. So you have, how many days have you spent in the courtroom or close to the courtroom?
Well, today was my first day, actually. I've been trying to get over there, but someone named Rung took my pass every day, so.
Uh-oh. That guy.
You know, there's only so many to go around. But, yeah, no, today was my first day, but obviously watching it almost every day. But, yeah, today was my first day, actually, in court.
Well, what has struck you? Let's start with you know, obviously, first the prosecution presents their case. They called several officers who were on the scene. They called, you know, ballistic experts. They called a coroner. What were some of the elements of the prosecution's case that really stuck out for you?
Well, I think one of the effective things, and you heard it today, was the element of time, right? We heard the prosecutor state in her closing of all the options that Van Dyke had, including, you know, time. I think that was fairly effective. On the other hand, you know, I think that somewhat conflicts with what we saw in the video. The state was trying to show, and they argued today, one of their, you know, the central components of their argument today was that Van Dyke had several other options, right? He could have boxed him in, he could have bumped Laquan McDonald with his car, he could have used the taser, waited for the taser, he could have retreated to his car, all these other options. I think that was an effective argument to show that what he did was unreasonable. But I do think it conflicts with what you saw in the video. And, you know, Van Dyke referenced this a little bit, I think very inartfully and not very articulately, but I think he did mention that, you know, it happened very quickly. And if you look at the video, for example, if you take the boxing in idea, I mean, there's no way he could have retreated back to his car, set up this tactical maneuver in his vehicle, you know, coordinated with the other vehicles on the scene. That's just, I don't think that would have been reasonable given the quickness of what happened on the video. So, you know, on the one hand, I think that was fairly effective, but I do think, you know, that the jury is going to be looking at that hard over the next day or so, however long they deliberate, and I think there is some inconsistency there.
Rich, WGN-TV talked tonight, and I think some of the other media outlets did as well, with some of the alternate jurors who were dismissed. And I want to ask you about that. Two definitely said they would have voted guilty. Now,
yes,
I didn't hear what the others said, but the two that I listened to said that they would have found him guilty for various reasons or for different reasons. But I guess as us watching that, again, I know we're all armchair quarterbacking this. We're not the jury. We're not the ones deciding. We're not the ones who have all of our time invested in this as far as being in the courtroom and listening to all the evidence verbatim. But what can we take away from the alternate juror's response? Should that be any indication of how the others are feeling, or absolutely not? Complete opposite.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think, you know, they're a pretty good preview of what the jury is thinking, right? I mean, they were there. They are in the shoes of the jurors, even though they were alternates. I think that they, you know, they're alternates for a reason. If there's any issue with the jury, they step in. So the fact that the two that we heard from said they would have voted guilty. Now, I don't think they specified whether they were going to vote, you know, guilty and then to lesser charge of second degree or what. But the fact that they both said that they were going to vote guilty, I think, is a pretty accurate preview of what the jury is thinking. Now, again, you know, they are not going through the deliberations. To your point, you know, there's a reason that there is a sequestering. There's a reason that there's a deliberation process. So the fact that their gut reaction is guilty doesn't mean that the jury will come back guilty, right? I mean, we've all seen many examples of trials where you hear from jurors that their initial gut was one thing and they deliberated and came to another. So, well, I think it's an accurate, you know, feeling of what the rest of the jurors are thinking. I don't know that it previews exactly what will happen.
How much does the offer to consider second-degree murder change those deliberations today?
Oh, that's huge. I mean, I think everyone agrees that that is an incredible development. I think that it allows the jury to come up with a compromise that they would not otherwise have. You know, it's incredibly historic that to convict a police officer of first-degree murder would be an incredible statement, would be incredibly difficult, I think, for anyone to do. Not that they won't do that, not that it's impossible, not that the evidence doesn't, you know, necessarily support that. But to give them a credible alternative, a compromise that accomplishes the goal of punishing him and giving Van Dyke real jail time while not putting him in jail for 22 life, I think is a really powerful development.
Rich, based on your experiences from jurors that you have polled over your career, what's the first thing that they would do? Would they go in? Patty and I were trying to figure this out earlier. Would they immediately say, let's take a vote on first degree, let's take a vote on second degree? And I know you're speculating, but what do you think their movements were?
Yeah, generally, you know, you're absolutely right. Generally, they will take, you know, an initial vote. They'll see if there's a consensus, and then it goes from there. I mean, if there is a consensus and there is 12 people who agree, then, you know, it's a pretty quick development. But generally, you'll have the initial vote. There'll be some disagreement, and then, you know, off you go from there. But, yeah, I think the first thing they do when they get back there after determining who the four person is they do a quick vote.
So we're 5 hours into the deliberations. I know, again, everybody always says, oh, if it's quick, it's guilty. I know you can never really judge, but we're 5 hours in. Do you anticipate, again, best guess, this coming back sooner, or are we going to be here for another week?
I think, I mean, I told Ro and Anna earlier that I think it's going to be tomorrow. I mean, that might be, you know, for a couple reasons, I think that is accurate. I mean, you know, Columbus Day is Monday. I wouldn't want to be in a motel somewhere, you know, on Columbus Day. Not that that is going to be the overriding factor, but these are human beings who have been sitting there for 3 weeks. I mean, not that that's the longest criminal trial in history, but, you know, would any one of us want to be doing that for 3 weeks? No. And I honestly think that, you know, it's a fairly simple issue. I don't say that as a means to oversimplify the importance of it, but, you know, this is not a trial involving hundreds of pieces of evidence and, you know, dozens of witnesses. I mean, it's a fairly straightforward issue. And, you know, not the least of which reason is because there's the video. I mean, at the end of the day, the video really tells a lot of the story of the case, and either you believe that the video supports one side or the other. So I don't know. From my perspective, I think it's a fairly straightforward issue, and I feel like the trial moved fairly quickly. My gut tells me that they're going to come up with a quick decision, but, you know, to your point, who knows? You really have no idea what they're thinking or what's going on in that room.
Rich, there's a listener who wonders in regards to the alternate jurors making comments. Can that be used as a grounds for mistrial, or because they've been dismissed and the jury has been sequestered, it really has no effect?
Yeah, they're done. I mean, once they're done, they're done. That's why, you know, when you speak to a jury, when you poll a jury afterwards, that's perfectly, you know, acceptable. They're done. I mean, they're free to, you know, do what they want. In some circumstances, you know, there are limits as to whether they can write a book or profit from it. But, yeah, I mean, the jury system is such that once you are discharged, you are free to do what you want.
And the other question somebody, I don't know if this isn't really a question, it's more of an observation. I'm wondering what your take was on the prosecutors. The 312 says they had to go to another county, Kane County, to get special prosecutors, and this was the best they could get. I've been a trial lawyer for 30-plus years, and these two reminded me of Marsha Clark and Chris Darden in the O.J. case.
So I hate to, you know, listen, as a professional and as a legal analyst, I hate to criticize others, but I feel like I have to in this case, and I agree with your caller, and I agree with what you said earlier. I really was surprised by the cross. I mean, you said earlier, Patty, that they went light on him. I couldn't believe it. I mean, I've seen attorneys. I do a lot of civil law and a lot of, you know, I do a lot of complex work too, but I also do a lot of basic, you know, one plaintiff versus one defendant. I've seen lawyers that are killers in those kind of cases, and this is, you know, again, one of the biggest trials in the history of Chicago, how you don't bring your A game, how you don't come out swinging. And, you know, there were so many opportunities to go after Van Dyke, and they just stopped. I mean, you all talked about earlier with Eric that they just let him off the hook.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's not even, you don't even have to know the ins and outs of this case. It's basic criminal procedure. It's like things you learn in law school. If someone is not answering the question, which he was doing all day, you know, on Thursday, you go after him, or on Wednesday, whenever he testifies, you go after him. I mean, that's a perfect chance to go after him, and don't let him off the hook. To my mind, he was controlling the dynamic of that testimony. Eric pointed out earlier, and we all saw how many pauses he had. Mm-hmm. I mean, listen, those are basic tricks that any, you know, attorney teaches their clients. The reason that he was pausing was because he was trying to throw her off, and he did. You know, listen, any human being, if you have to ask the same question three times, you think the third time is going to be as effective as the first time? Of course not. She came in, you know, she had her first question was her strongest. If I tell you, oh, I don't understand, you have to repeat it three times, it's like, you know, you're photocopying a photocopy, right?
Yes.
That third copy is going to be terrible.
Yeah, I wasn't sure if it was just, you know, my personal opinion, because it seems as though she stopped in mid-sentence when she stopped asking him questions.
He threw her off completely. I mean, you know, and the pause is, I mean, one practical reason why I tell my clients to pause, and any attorney does, is because you want to let an objection jump in. I mean, you know, the way I tell my clients is you can't put the toothpaste back in the tube, even though if you answer a question and then I object, the judge can say to the jury, disregard what he said. It's too late. You've answered it. So Van Dyke did a very effective job in pausing. That allowed, even though Herbert didn't really object too much, it gives your attorney a chance to object without your answer being, you know, out there in the ether. So I thought Van Dyke, even though I really think he was not credible, because I thought there were so many instances where he came across as robotic and avoiding the answer, I really think he won that exchange.
Rich, in the opening statements, the prosecution brought up race, and that was one of the last times I heard it brought up. I expected to hear a little bit more about that, but it seemed to not play toward their argument. Roe actually had on Jason Van Dyke's brother-in-law, who's African-American, and said he's not a racist, he's a great guy, he's a guy everybody wants to be around. I was surprised he didn't take the stand, because he would have been, to me, a good character witness for him. But were you surprised they didn't play that angle a little more?
A little bit. I mean, we actually, you and I, we all talked about that last time. Yeah. I was on. Yeah, I was a little surprised. I mean, certainly that issue is out there, and you know, we see the protests, and we see his great uncle. I mean, it's obviously an issue. You know, when I walked out of WGN earlier today, you know, there was probably 100 police on, you know, horseback, lining Wacker Drive. That wouldn't happen, I don't think, in a trial where race wasn't an issue. That being said, you know, as a prosecutor, you have to decide whether you're going to go that way, because once you open that door, you can't close it, right? And then the whole trial, I think, becomes about race. I think the prosecution felt like they had enough evidence in this case to not raise that. Yeah, I thought it was going to be more of an issue, but I'm not totally surprised that they didn't go that way.
We need to take a quick break and then do a couple minutes with you, if you don't mind, about
sure.
the pending vote to get Judge Kavanaugh out of the Judiciary Committee and into the Senate for his confirmation in the Supreme Court. So hold on. We are hanging out with Rich Lenkoff. He co-hosts the Legal Face-Off with Tina Martini, and obviously regular contributor here at WGN Radio. More in a moment on 720 WGN. The FBI has submitted their report after the pause button was hit by Senator Flake and Senator Coons last week during the Judiciary Committee hearings. And I wanted to see what Rich Lenkoff thought. You're listening to the Patty Vasquez Show with Andre Darlis. And Rich, did you see the piece that Judge Kavanaugh wrote today saying, "That's not me. I was really upset. Yeah, I'm going to be very impartial."
Yeah, I was a little emotional during my hearings. Do you think, Judge? Do you think you were maybe a little bit out of line? I mean, I don't buy it. You know, I thought his performance was ridiculous, and I mean, in and of itself, I think would be a disqualifier for the Supreme Court. So now his backtracking in light of, you know, the massive outpouring of, you know, negativity over his testimony, I think it's too late. I think he showed his true colors. So I saw the piece, I read it, and I dismiss it. I think he'll be that way on the court, and I worry for the future of the Supreme Court.
So it sounds as though you believe he will be confirmed.
Oh, no question. I mean, I think that ship has sailed. I don't think he should be. You know, I think I agree with I don't know who's telling the truth, but I think, like anything, I interview many people and have interviewed hundreds of people and hired dozens of them, and you know, if someone came in and I was suspicious of them being abusive or raping or, you know, over drinking, that would be enough, right? And that's an employee. That's not one of the 9 most important legal people in the world. So but yeah, to answer your question, I think he's got the votes. I think it's all, you know, it's all reduced to politics, and I think he'll be confirmed.
I agree with you, Rich, and it is unfortunate because, you know, you are talking about a sexual assault allegation, not from one, not from two, not multiple women now coming forward. And that's what's troubling, is that all the other nominees, John Edwards, Neil Gorsuch, whoever, it's always going to fall along party lines. You're not going to agree with their politics. That's fine. But this is almost like a game changer. Do you recall anything like this? Again, not things will fall along party lines, but this is such a game changer. Mm-hmm. I mean, this should be women, men, Democrat, Republican, independents should all be saying, wait a minute, you know, this is a serious allegation.
Yeah, I mean, listen, we all believe in due process. We all believe in presumption of innocence. But by the same token, there's enough there to at least disqualify. I mean, why even go into a lifetime appointment for someone who will be on the court for 30 or even 40 years with this doubt? I mean, that doesn't help anyone. Just, you know, there's plenty of other qualified candidates who aren't being accused of rape. I mean, there's dozens, if not hundreds, of people who could fill that job capably and actually would be a bigger asset for Trump, you know, because they're more conservative, they're younger. We talked last time I was on about Amy Barracone. She's, you know, almost 10 years younger, and she's far more conservative, and she would sail through the confirmation process. But, you know, Trump is so stubborn, and, you know, he just wants to put on this guy and stick with him. I think it's ridiculous, but you know, that's the world we're living in.
I was struck by something today as I was reading more about Lindsey Graham, and of course that moment on the at the hearings where he basically threw down the gauntlet and rallied the rest of the Republicans behind him, and that was when things really turned around. And it struck me that when people talk about how powerful Michael Madigan is in the state of Illinois, I realize that Lindsey Graham holds a lot of power over Americans in this position he has in the Judiciary Committee. I don't know if that's something that people have thought about. I mean, people are always like, we should get rid of Michael Madigan. Well, the people in his district vote for him, and this is the way it works. You know, and the people in Lindsey Graham's district vote for him, and this is the way it works.
He does. I mean, you know, the Republicans have the majority in the Senate. They have the majority on the Judiciary Committee. Mitch McConnell, you know, is incredibly loyal. I mean, listen, as they all are, you can't, on the one hand, you can't fault the Republicans for doing what they're doing because that's the way they all are. I mean, they don't care, I think, about what's right or wrong. Nor, I mean, the Democrats, unfortunately, would be doing the same thing if they were in the majority and the, you know, it was someone that was on the other side. I mean, I think the unfortunate reality of this is that it just goes down party lines regardless of what's right or wrong. I think objectively, this person should not be on the court given the allegations of what we heard. We're not talking about a Bork situation. You know, Bork was rejected because of his views. That is different from the situation here where you've got, you know, tons of credible evidence that this person committed, you know, acts that should disqualify him from the court.
I want to thank you so much for your time, Rich, and obviously we'll know more possibly tomorrow and in the week to come, but we'll keep in touch and catch up with you again. And everyone can check out Legal Face Off, available on WGNplus.com, that Rich co-hosts with Tina Martini. Thank you, Rich.
Thanks very much. Appreciate
Hi, Rich.
It.
Get some rest, will you? I know it's going to be a long weekend. Talk to you later. More after this on 720 WGN.